Can we just have a moment, counsel, while opposing counsel's getting settled?
I was just going to say we have the same argument next Wednesday.
Well, this is available on video if you want to use it.
Hold on, I can't hear a word you're saying.
I said this is on video, so if you want to refresh yourself about how the argument went, you can surely review it.
Say it again, Your Honor.
I said all our arguments are on video and stored, so if you want to, you have the same argument next Wednesday, you might want to look at the video.
It's a Doyle argument, but it's kind of the same.
All right, we're ready to go, if you are.
You betcha. My name is Michael Bigelow, if it please the court, and I represent Mr. Mendoza in this matter. The first thing I would like to do before we get into the areas that I think you're going to want to get into is that in my reply brief at page 22, I made a horrible mistake, and I attempted to quote magistrate judges' findings. It's in the tolling section of my reply brief, and I misquoted it, although not by much. The part that I wanted to quote was his findings at the further excerpts of record, page 37. And I would note also that the AG filed objections in document 24, which is not part of the excerpts of record, but he referenced that same section at page 8 and conceded to the magistrate judge's findings. All right, that said, let me start with this. Judge Hurwitz, you and Judge Watford, about 3 weeks ago, took a U.S. attorney to task because he was trying to prove plea negotiations, in the Schwartz case, I think it was. He was trying to prove plea negotiations, but had absolutely no evidence to support any facet of his explanation that there were, in fact, plea negotiations. That's not the case here.
So, counsel, could we get to the point in this case? The point is that there was a plea, and I think everyone agrees that there was ineffective assistance of counsel in this case, right?
Or deficient assistance.
Deficient. There was a deficiency in the representation. The issue becomes whether or not there's prejudice.
I couldn't agree more, Your Honor. I think the AG will disagree with you.
Well, if you think the AG will disagree that there was a finding of ineffective assistance or deficient performance, the AG can speak for himself. But if I thought the court found there was deficient,
all three courts did.
Okay.
Four judges did.
Okay, let's start from that premise. But also found no prejudice, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so tell us why that finding of no prejudice was contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. And do you agree that the law is Strickland?
That the law is what, Your Honor?
The applicable law is Strickland.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so tell us why that finding of no prejudice is contrary to or an unreasonable application of Strickland?
It's unreasonable, as two magistrate judges found.
And one district judge found the other way. So, I mean, and some state court judges found the other way. We're not counting the number of judges on one side or another. So tell us why.
But on these same facts.
But
well, that's not really
that
true. Okay,
that doesn't get us where we need to go.
Tell us why in this case the record establishes that your client would not have pleaded guilty had he known that this would have been his second strike.
Let me preface it. just a little bit by saying that this information, the information that I am about to argue, was before the Superior Court judge as well as...
Well, let me make it easier for you. Let me tell you what I think the record shows us in this case, and then you can tell us, whether or not it was enough. This was, no one disputes, this was a second strike, correct?
Actually, no, it was a first strike, not a second strike.
Well, okay, but it wasn't a third strike. This guilty plea did not make him, was not his third strike, correct?
Whether it was or was not.
Yes. Okay, you can tell me why it doesn't matter in a minute. I'm just trying to establish the facts. He was charged with crimes that would have given him a potential sentence of, I think, 10 years. Am I correct?
Give or take.
And he pleaded. Some of them were dismissed in return for his guilty plea. And he got a three-year sentence.
Correct.
And whatever effect this conviction had, it didn't increase his sentence at all. In other words, it wasn't a third strike.
That's not the prejudice.
Could you just answer the question, yes. Counsel?
Okay. Yes,
okay.
I'm sorry.
So given all that, here's what I have. I have somebody accused of a serious crime in which he appears to have no defense because the DNA evidence shows he pleaded guilty, and everybody conceded at the time of the guilty plea it was a strong case because the colloquy is in here. He doesn't seem to have a good defense. He pleads guilty and reduces substantially the amount of time that he faces if he had gone to trial, and this conviction is not a third strike. So those are the facts I know from the record. Tell me why those aren't enough to make the state court tell me why they're not enough to show why the state court non-prejudice finding was unreasonable.
Lee says you're focusing on the wrong issue. You're focusing on the length of the sentence. You're focusing on whether or not he'd be convicted. You're focusing on the sentence. The prejudice in this case is not the sentence. The prejudice in this case is not the strike. The prejudice in this case is that because of his attorney's ineffective assistance and misadvice, he pled guilty and gave to something he didn't want to plead guilty to. He didn't.
Okay, so your side of the argument has got to be, had he been properly advised, he would not have pleaded guilty.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, and we know from our case law that a defendant merely saying so isn't enough to establish that. We have to look at all the facts of the case. So I'm trying to ask you to address the facts of the case and tell me why, given those, it wasn't a reasonable conclusion for the state court to find no prejudice.
He said he didn't want to plead.
What else is there? He said he wouldn't have pled guilty. What else is there in the record to corroborate his statement that he would not have pled guilty if he had known it would result in a second strike? What's in the record?
The transcript itself is in the record and very much a part of his explanation. Trial counsel said, we found this section. This is the section. And the judge says, it's not a strike. And everybody says, yeah, it's not a strike. And so the guy pleads. He pleads on the last day of trial, or he pleads on the day of trial, at least. He knew what a strike was because he had a strike, but it was a subsequent strike, which is why what he pled to was not a second
strike. What he pled to would have been a first strike.
The one he pled to was the first.
Right, but his prior one would have been a second, and his prior conviction would have been a second, in effect, right? In other words, after this was all over, he had two strikes, did he not?
No, after this was all over, well, yes.
Yes.
Yes, he had a subsequent strike, yes, mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So here's...
He knew what a strike was. He did not want a strike.
No one wants a strike, but here's my question. He got a pretty good deal, it seems to me, based on this record. Nobody's disputing that. Nobody's disputing that he was properly advised except for the strike. So what you're really saying is, he was worried that he might commit a felony sometime in the future. that would qualify as a third strike.
No, no. That is an incorrect analysis, Your Honor. That's the analysis that the Lee court said you can't do. You can't worry about those kinds of things.
What kinds of things?
The sentence. You've got to focus on the sentence itself, on the consequences of the sentence. What was this defendant deprived of because his lawyer gave him misadvice? He was deprived of the right to go to trial.
We all agree about that. So I take it your argument is, since the defendant says he wouldn't have pleaded guilty had he been told this qualified as a strike, the state court finding of no prejudice is unreasonable.
Yes.
Is there anything else that makes it unreasonable? I mean, you may be right. I'm just trying to explore the record. Anything else that we should take into account in determining whether or not the state court prejudice determination was unreasonable? Other than the defendant saying, I wouldn't have done it, which I think is pretty well established by the record. I don't think anybody doubts that. He says it.
Well, other than the very things that the magistrate judge found, and you know, that is that he had multiple conversations with his lawyer, that he did not want to plead guilty.
Counsel, may I ask you, if we agree with you, what would be the appropriate remedy if we agree with you and say that state court's finding of prejudice was unreasonable? Then what happens?
It's a little bit out of the park. I would agree with you. I think the only thing this court can do is to vacate, reverse the conviction, reverse the judgment.
They could retry him, couldn't they?
I'm sorry?
Could they retry him?
Yeah, I think they probably could.
Yeah, I mean, but I always wonder.
I think the conviction gets reversed. Do I want that? No.
Well, and with the evidence they have, which I know you might dispute, but at least in looking at it as a habeas judge, I want to be tried if this
did you read my transfer? Did you read my transfer memo?
The problem is sometimes be careful what you ask for, because if we agree with you and reverse the case and he withdraws his guilty plea, then we're back at square one and the government can take him to trial.
I learned a long time ago that if your lawyer, and this is exactly what this trial counsel should have done, if your client tells you he wants to do something, you got two choices. You withdraw from the case or you do what he does, unless it's illegal. All right. Everything from day one, 9 years this case has been going on, it's been, I want my conviction reversed.
Okay.
Yeah, and your client's entitled.
Of course he is.
I'm sorry, you were over talking.
Of course your client is entitled to that. I just wanted to be sure that we were clear about what the ramifications of that might be.
Yes, no, that's it. Have any further questions? I'll reserve my 2.5 minutes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I've got to collect all my stuff together.
Good morning. May it please the court. Justin Riley on behalf of the appellee.
Can you, at the beginning, can you help us out and tell us, was the state court finding a Chapman finding? In other words, there's a state court finding of no prejudice. Where is it and how do we review it? Where is it? Where do I find it in the
record?
That
is...
Yes.
I'm
trying to figure out when we're reviewing a California Supreme Court denial of habeas, or are we reviewing a superior court? What are we doing?
If Your Honor is referring to the Robinson case out of California.
No, I'm actually referring to, I'm just trying to find where in the record is the finding of no prejudice by the state court that we're reviewing for reasonableness.
In other words, what was the last reasoned decision? Do you agree that we review the last reasoned decision?
I do agree that you review the last reasoned decision.
What was that in this case?
I make the argument in my brief that was the California Supreme Court silent denial on.
So it's a silent. So you think it's the silent denial?
Exactly.
And therefore, because we do the California Supreme Court's work for them on silent denials, exactly. We should view that as a Chapman beyond a reasonable doubt, no prejudice finding.
No, that would still be a Strickland denial. But
how is it a reasoned decision, though? How is that a reasoned decision under Strickland?
Harrington versus Richter. Out of the Supreme Court has described the collateral review silent denials out of California as merits adjudication.
Right, but that doesn't. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. There is a Superior Court. That's what I was trying to get to. There's a Superior Court order in this case.
Exactly.
Do we look through the California California Supreme Court's postcard denial, if you will, to the Superior Court order to figure out what the prejudice finding is?
That has been always what this court has done up until the Robinson case. And Robinson, in Robinson, this court certified a question to the California Supreme Court regarding timeliness. And one of the premises upon which that certified question was issued is that the California Supreme Court on collateral review, the higher courts reviewed the lower court decisions. And so in the Ninth Circuit Robinson case, the panel was worried about, do the intervals between those denials on collateral review, do they toll, essentially? In answering that question, the California Supreme Court in Robinson had to address the review question specifically and said, the premise is all wrong. We do not directly review lower court decisions. And that was a sea change. Going back almost 20 years, the United States Supreme Court, using the Yule's presumption, presumed that California courts were reviewing lower court decisions in some way, shape, or form.
That's not true in habeas. That's always been distinct decisions in habeas. The California Supreme Court, a habeas petition can be filed first in the California Supreme Court. And so that's never been true for habeas, that the California Supreme Court was reviewing the lower court's decision.
The line of cases from the Supreme Court are timeliness cases, but they start with Saffold. And what the United States Supreme Court presumed that California was doing is, on collateral review, as it acted like direct review. They recognized that original jurisdiction was kind of an odd duck.
Did that do away with the look-through? That's my question.
Right.
Because here, let me start at the bottom end, and you can know what I'm shooting at. The Superior Court order denying California habeas relief says that the petitioner has not carried his burden of showing prejudice. If, in fact, there was constitutional error. Now, the question is whether that's the second half of Strickland prejudice, or is it prejudice from ineffective assistance of counsel? So is that the correct argument that he has? He has to discharge a Strickland burden of showing prejudice?
The claim has always been Strickland, so no matter which.
I'm trying to figure out what we're reviewing. Did the California Supreme Court say, and it's an imaginary decision that we're making up for it, he didn't meet his burden of showing the second half of Strickland? Or did it say any constitutional error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, to use your paraphrase, imagine, Harrington versus Richter says when you get one of those silent denials from the California Supreme Court or any state court on collateral review, you imagine any reasonable way in which the
yeah, see, I can't imagine any reasonable way the California Supreme Court would address this, except to look at the two prongs of Strickland.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. And we all agree. I think, contrary, I hope we agree, that counsel should have told them this was a second strike.
If we are reviewing the California Supreme Court's decision, one reasonable way to deny a relief
Do you take issue with the fact that the performance was deficient?
You think this is the level of professional care one expects from a lawyer in California?
Advice, if we're to credit petitioner's allegation that this is what counsel told me, the advice.
Well, the judge told him.
Yeah, the judge, everyone.
Everyone told him. The prosecutor told him. The judge told him. His counsel told him. Everybody thought this wasn't a strike. If your argument is, well, he couldn't have been deficient because everybody else in the room thought it was one too, I'd understand that. But surely this is deficient performance, isn't it?
Deficient performance is a term of art. It was assuredly incorrect advice.
First, did he satisfy the first prong of Strickland? Could any reasonable jurist find that in this case, advising somebody that a conviction did not have an important consequence incorrectly doesn't qualify you for the first prong of Strickland? You know, I don't know why you want to fight your battle on the first prong.
I really don't. This is not my strongest argument. I'm being asked the question, so I want to
sound
be correct
about
it.
Sound like you want to die on that hill.
I'd much rather go
okay.
to time
so,
on this.
So take, us to, what we, take but, us to what we've all been interested okay. in, because I think if you think you got to win on the first prong of Strickland, you might be back at a trial. We're talking about prejudice now.
Exactly. On prejudice.
What do we analyze in order to determine whether there was prejudice? And what did the state courts analyze in order to determine whether there was prejudice?
As Judge Rawlinson mentioned, it's Strickland by way of Hill, by way of Lee versus United States is one of the last examples of how a court is to review this claim on prejudice. And Hill tells us that the petitioner must prove that properly advised, he would have insisted on a trial. If we go to Lee sets out as a general matter. It makes sense the defendant who has no realistic defense to a charge supported by sufficient evidence will be unable to carry his burden of showing prejudice from accepting a guilty plea. That's the general rule. If you had a weak defense and you got a better outcome than you would have going to trial, you pretty much can't show prejudice. However, if you can show that there was another matter of such paramount importance that it would be rational under the circumstances to instead insist upon a trial, then maybe you can make out your prejudice claim.
But isn't that the argument that opposing counsel is making, that the strike consideration was of such paramount importance that he would not have gone to trial, that he would not have pled?
That was never his specific allegation. He said, I would rather not have had a second strike on my record. Now, that was his allegation. As your honors have mentioned, both the state court and the federal court require you, if you're trying to overturn a plea, that you come up with corroborating evidence of your allegations.
Was there an evidentiary hearing in the Superior Court?
I'm sorry?
I don't think there was. There was no evidentiary hearing in the Superior Court on the habeas, was there?
No. Further evidence was taken in the Superior Court on collateral review, but no hearing was held, if you will.
What was the further evidence?
For example, in the Superior Court, petitioner added a few allegations to his petition, and then the prosecutor's office filed an informal response, adding more information to the file, to the record. And then on in the Court of Appeal, when petitioner filed his state Court of Appeal petition, he added his federal defender's declaration regarding some of the conversations that she had with trial counsel. That was a bit more evidence. Essentially, defense counsel said, I don't remember this case specifically, but I don't know why I would have advised petitioner that this wasn't a strike. So that was further evidence. But petitioner needed to show with additional evidence that this was of such paramount importance. And what the Superior Court, essentially what the Superior Court and the district judge ultimately found was that it didn't make sense that one would put such paramount importance on a speculative benefit and risk
Let me try a hypothetical situation.
Yes.
And I'm not sure anybody asked for the defendant to take the stand. He takes the stand and says convincingly, sorry, I wouldn't have done it. And the judge says, I believe you. He doesn't need more than that, does he?
He does. In Lee, if you read through the procedure, what happened in Lee is Lee wanted to undo his guilty plea. And both Lee and his trial counsel both took the stand in post-trial proceedings.
But the judge said, I don't buy it because there's other evidence. I'm positing to you a hypothetical situation where a defendant gets up there, and any of us who ever represented a defendant know that defendants aren't always rational, and says, yeah, it looks like a heck of a deal, but I would not have taken it had they told me it was a strike. And the judge looks at that person in the eye and measures the credibility of that person and says, I believe you. Then the judge should grant relief in this case, right?
No.
That happened.
Also, in addition, Padilla versus Kentucky cited in Lee, the decision to insist upon a trial has to be rational under the circumstances.
See, but those are all cases in which somebody is saying, I'm trying to decide whether or not I believe the defendant. And so I look at all the surrounding circumstances, and I don't care what he says. No more, you know, no one would turn down the deal he got. I understand that. My question is a very simple one. Would it be sufficient for a judge to listen to a defendant on the stand and say, I believe you, you would not have taken the plea? That would be enough for the judge to find Strickland prejudice, wouldn't it?
The short answer, Your Honor, is I don't know. And I would like a lot more time to research that issue before I represented to a three-judge panel that was correct. And I'm sorry about that.
The judge who held the habeas in this case was the same judge who tried the case?
I do not know that. That would be relatively easy to cross-reference.
If you don't know it, we can figure it out.
I don't. Unless there are any more questions, there was another topic of timeliness. I think the biggest mistake that some of the courts have made, both in support of this conclusion and the judges making the conclusion on the factual predicate matter, is that they were describing the fact of misadvice was what was newly discovered, the fact of misadvice. And the problem with saying it that way is misadvice, much like deficient performance, is a mixed question of law and fact.
And you may be right about that, but I got to tell you, here's what troubles me about the case. The defendant shows up in the courtroom, his lawyer, the prosecutor, and the judge all say this is not a strike. Mm-hmm. And your position is he should have been on notice that day that they were all wrong, because that's the logical implication of your position. And I'm not sure we have to reach it in this case. I'm just saying that logical implication troubles me a lot.
It would be a very difficult outcome, yes. I've had statute of limitations come down to one day before, and it's difficult.
No, but the concept that a defendant, you know, a non-lawyer defendant, should be on notice that the judge, the prosecutor, and his attorney are all wrong, that's a very tough sale.
It is a tougher case on that. Factual has to mean something. It's part of the statutory.
Well, it means something, but I'm not sure it means that.
I will leave that one unless there are any other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Told you so. Conviction at trial was not inevitable. It wasn't. This was, I think, a first offense for him. He wouldn't have gotten 9 years. Maybe he would have gotten the midterm, California's midterm.
He would have gotten more than three, probably.
More than three. He wouldn't have had the strike. He would have been able to go to trial. More than three. Who?
Well, he would still have a strike.
Well,
he would have still had a strike if he were convicted.
Well, you want to know what I think really happened in this case? Did you read?
I want to know what the law says. I don't really care too much about what you think. I just want to know what the law says and if you're entitled
fair
to relief.
Enough. His affidavit says, I would have gone to trial if I'd known I was pleading to a strike. That's him standing up, sitting up.
No, and, I understand. Okay. No, we're asking a question now, about the strength.
The corroboration
Counsel,
of
please
that.
Don't interrupt the judge.
Asking a question about this.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I talked over you, so I don't take any offense at it at all. We're asking, I think, Judge Rollins and I about the strength of the case. And in looking at what little we're told about the case, it seems like we could, you know, anybody could have gotten a conviction in this case. His defense seems to be that the semen that you found in the victim was transferred there somehow.
Well, touch transfer.
Mine.
It's a legitimate
transfer works very well. Except when semen is found in a vagina, it strikes me as a little bit more difficult.
It's still a defense. It's still reasonable doubt. I'd argue that in front of a jury in a heartbeat, Your Honor. If I had a defendant who wanted to go to trial on that, I'd argue in a heartbeat.
Would you argue with a straight face?
I don't need a straight face, Your Honor. I'm a defense lawyer.
Good for you.
You know what? And I will guarantee you on the facts of that case, I'd get one juror. I would get one juror, and that's all I care about. And
you're very confident in your ability, I'll tell you.
Not only do you have a straight face, but you must be a hell of a trial lawyer. Because when I look at this record, and it seems to me any rational, put aside the strike issue, any lawyer would say to his client on this record, if there's a deal to be had, we ought to get it.
No question. I mean, yes, absolutely. I would say take the deal. He'd say, I don't want to take the deal if it's a strike.
I understand
now,
that argument.
What corroborates that? And that was my point with your and Judge Watchford's discussion with we've got stuff he negotiated. The negotiation was all about getting rid of that strike. That's what it was. We've got enough evidence to infer that.
So we have more here than his statement. What we have, I've been trying to get you to say this all along, and so thank you for saying it at the end. We have more than his statement. We have a discussion in open court that everybody thought it was important that it not be a strike, and therefore that corroborates his statement that I wouldn't have done it.
And we have negotiations that corroborate his insistence on pleading to a non-strike. We have...
Counsel, you've exceeded your time, so if you could wrap up. We'll see if you get one judge here with your argument.
I'm wrapped up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both, counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court.